What did you do today?
Oh, same old, same old.
The audio described Groundhog Day, starring Bill Murray and Andy McDowell, Saturday night at 7 on Recording Library of West Texas Radio.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 49 and mostly cloudy. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 7 p.m.
Welcome to Texas Monthly Archives. Each Welcome to Texas Monthly Archives. Each week, Recording Library volunteers and staff dig into past editions of the National Magazine of Texas.
He can roll me on the prairie, and he can ride me on the plain, and I will be his Cinderella if he'll be my cowboy man.
Hello, this is Michael reading for Texas Monthly Archives. Feature: The Improbable Rise of Lyle Lovett. After a career singing his own sad, quirky songs, he's playing tribute to the eccentric bunch of redneck rockers who taught him all about Texas music more than 20 years ago. By Jan Reed. Published October 1998. In the lobby of a small, exclusive hotel on Manhattan's East Side, a limo driver and a bellman quietly discuss the whereabouts of Lyle Lovett. "Have you seen him?" asks the driver. The bellman nods. "Came through just a few minutes ago." "Was he with his friend?" asks the driver with a slight coded smile. The other's smile is smug with fresh knowledge. "No, another friend." I find him upstairs in his suite. He comes forward in a black shirt and trousers with a handshake offered and his long mouth parted in a grin. The man who married movie star Julia Roberts and became an inspiration for every guy who ever thought himself homely is slender with a large craggy head. His distinctive broomcorn shock of hair is lightly oiled, and at 40, he shows a little gray in the sideburns. Many women have told me they find Lyle Lovett very attractive. He is vain enough about his curious looks to tell photographers he favors the left side of his face. The left cheek is deeply furrowed, and he cocks the eyebrow with sly effect. Lovett and I have communicated and made overtures in the past, but never met. The occasion this August day is the release of his seventh album, Step Inside This House, Curb MCA. The two-disc, 21-song set contains none of Lovett's own material, but is a tribute to the Texas songwriters who helped shape his style. Among them, Guy Clark, Michael Martin Murphy, Walter Hyatt, Stephen Fromholtz, Townes Van Zandt, and Willis Allen Ramsey. It's an indication of Lovett's stature in the music business that he can release a double album of songs written by relatively unknown songwriters. But he has often done the strange and seemingly impossible in his career, defying every category and format, yet still selling millions of albums and packing concert halls, despite rarely getting on the radio. Almost in spite of himself, Lyle Lovett is a star. For me, the songs on Step Inside This House bring a rush of nostalgia for a magic time in Austin 25 years ago, long before Lovett's hairdo became a national topic of conversation. "The first time I encountered these songwriters was reading about them in your book," Lovett tells me. "I learned to play the guitar listening to some of these songs. For me, this record is going back to the beginning. It's kind of like taking stock and starting over." Lovett rests his arms on a conference table and watches me take materials out of a briefcase. "It's interesting to be introduced to people by reading about them," he remarks. and then learn about them by listening to their work. No matter how well you get to know them later, there's something about that quality they never lose. My book, The Improbable Rise of Redneck Rock, grew out of an article published in this magazine in 1973, the first year of its existence. My publisher was David Lindsay, a genteel man who would later go on to write best-selling crime novels. We thought that we were on to the hottest cultural uprising since Haight-Ashbury. As I chased between night spots in Austin, Dallas, and Houston, and wrote about musicians with their records blaring on my stereo, Lindsay pestered me for a title. I could roughly define this new Texas music, a fusion of rock and roll and country and western, folk, blues, and gospel. But I couldn't name it. An Austin radio station that aired the music called it progressive country. To me, that sounded like some political naif's wishful thinking. One day in Lindsay's office, I announced a breakthrough. I waved my hand like a band director, indicating the rough spots that could be filled in later. Da, 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 da of redneck rock. It may be the only original idea I have ever had, and I still don't know what it means exactly, but the live music scene, centered in Austin, seemed to have a strange quality that brought adverse elements together. Hippies and cedar choppers were kicking up their heels in the same dance halls. My book captured some of that, particularly in the chapters that profiled the singer-songwriters. I thought afterward that I should have learned more about their musicianship and printed fewer of their lyrics, but with the benefit of even further hindsight, I was right to do it the way that I did. It was really more about language than guitar licks. The songwriters who grabbed young Lyle Lovett's attention crafted some exceptional poetry. Unfortunately, the handful of radio stations that aired this crossbred Texas music soon moved on to other formats. Commercially abandoned, the musicians who had been celebrities in Austin were unable to do with their careers what Lovett has accomplished with his. Many of them left Texas. Clark, Murphy, Van Zant, Hyatt, Ramsey, Gary P. Nunn. Jerry Jeff Walker eventually salvaged his livelihood by sobering up and becoming a cult figure on college campuses. First, B.W. Stevenson, then Hyatt and Van Zant, died before their time. Kinky Friedman can still bring down a house with his outrageous tunes, but he prospers because he writes best-selling mystery novels featuring a wise guy detective named Kinky. Willie Nelson was the only one of the redneck rockers who truly became a national figure, and he had laid the floor for that with his Nashville songwriting in the 50s and 60s. Austin was permanently established as a live music mecca and proving ground for performers on their way up. But the scene I wrote about withered just as quickly as it had flowered. Steve Fromholtz was one who stayed in town and kept playing. 25 years ago, he seemed poised for some measure of stardom. He was handsome and funny, had a fine baritone, and was a splendid songwriter. But the fashions of music passed him by. He has carried on as an actor, a wilderness white water guide, and a somewhat jaded folk singer, cracking jokes about the great progressive country scare. In those days, he was unaware what a hero he was to a novice musician in College Station. I got to open for Fromholtz when he played clubs in the area, Lovett tells me. The first time, he listened to my set and was real encouraging and told me, "Nice job." Now suddenly, Fromholtz finds the favor returned with four of his songs on the record of an artist whose albums sell between 500,000 and a million copies. The royalties will likely bring him more money than he has ever seen as a musician. "I'm going to be a multi-thousandaire again," Fromholtz tells me, laughing. I don't know what progressive country was all about, but Lyle Lovett was sure paying attention. The doorbell rings and a hotel bellhop comes in with a tray of ice water and coffee. Lovett serves the coffee with a mannerliness that seems deeply ingrained. He often mentions proudly that his family has been in Texas since the 1840s. He makes his home today north of Houston, in a house his grandparents built in 1911 in an enclave of kinfolks living on parcels of divided farmland. I grew up around spring when it was still very much out in the country, he says. It was just an unincorporated farming community. We were watching the city come out to us and take over. So when I read about Steve Fromholtz and found the record with Texas Trilogy, a trio of songs featuring Hard Luck Ranchers, Boyhood Train Rides, and the Tiny Burg of Copperell, those songs meant a lot to me. They spoke to my upbringing. Lovett graduated from Klein High School and went to Texas A&M University because it was close to home. He lived in a dorm and fell in with others who spent the evenings trying to learn to play a guitar all the way through a song. He befriended an English major who also had a bright future in Texas music, Robert Earl Keen. Lovett served on a student union committee that booked performers into the campus coffee house. The first time I saw Michael Murphy was in 1975, he says. He came out by himself, and the whole first half of the show just stood there and told stories and played songs. I thought, man, I want to get to where I can do that someday. His chance to learn wasn't long in coming. I was 18 when I first started performing, he says. I came home from school the summer of 1976, and along with a buddy who played guitar, I got a job in the bar of a restaurant close to home, on Farm to Market 1960. As much as I liked Willie Nelson, we didn't cover his songs. I wanted songs that were new to an audience, and Willie was on the radio all the time. We did a lot of Fromholtz songs. Bears and the Trilogy were some of the first songs I learned. We did Murphy songs and Willis Allen Ramsey songs. I sang Spider John more times than I could count. Lovett reminisces about majoring in journalism and writing for the campus newspaper, The Battalion. The editors let me write stories about musicians who came through the area playing gigs. That's when I realized I couldn't ever be a journalist, he says, smiling. I could never be objective. I went to interview Eric Taylor, one of the songwriters covered on his new album, and got him to teach me to play Memphis Midnight. I interviewed Fromholtz, Murphy, Ramsey, just about all of them. How did it go with Willis? I ask him. I tell him that because of perceived journalistic sins that I could never repent for fully enough. My relationship with Ramsey was troubled, deteriorating at one point into a shouting match at an Austin nightclub. Lovett's lips become long, thin lines when he grins. You know, he was so young then. Of course, you were young too. I'll never forget my first conversation with Willis. He and his manager had gone to the fanciest restaurant in Bryan. When I interviewed him, he was eating a filet mignon out of his hand. In 1972, on the day Ramsey turned 21, he had finished recording a debut album with the help of rock stars Leon Russell, Greg Allman, and J.J. Cale. Song after song, including the future Captain and Tennille mega hit Muskrat Love, was coy, melodic, brilliant. But the second album failed to materialize, and Ramsey moved to Nashville as the Austin scene began to fade. He eventually wound up in Scotland, where he spent several years living in a lighthouse. Willis taught me so much, Lovett tells me. Listening to his record showed me that you don't have to play straight-ahead blues to have blues be a part of your music. He's so soulful. What do you mean? How did he teach you? Well, just with his vocal style. He's not playing the shuffle kind of stuff you hear in a bar on 6th Street in Austin. He does it with narrative that's not restricted to the 16-bar blues form. Willis and I have gotten really close, Lovett continues. I talk to him all the time now, but I didn't really know him until he came back to Nashville from Scotland. I'd see him at Walter Hyatt's house. I played Sleepwalking a couple of years ago when I was touring. The crowds always loved it, laughed at the right spots. He's got a bunch of good new songs. So there's going to be a second album? Lovett grins again and delicately pours more coffee. Willis is a perfectionist. Everything's got to be just right. By 1983, Lovett had 2 degrees from A&M, journalism and German. He has said he stayed in school for 6 years because it was easier to tell people he was a student than a little-known musician. I was playing the same half dozen clubs in Texas, he says. I'd come to realize I didn't know anything about the business of music. I was in Luxembourg that September playing an American music tent at a fair and met some musicians, Billy Williams and his band from Phoenix. I'd never recorded with the band before and was curious what that would sound like. When I got back, they helped me make a demo tape, and in 84, I went to Nashville. Lovett was not lacking in confidence. He went straight to the offices of the American Society of Composers and Publishers, a performing rights organization that represents songwriters, and left a tape. A membership representative was soon making calls and setting up appointments for him with publishers. Lovett left another copy of the tape with a brief note at the publishing company of Guy Clark, who had made a deep imprint on the Texas scene in the 70s with L.A. Freeway and other songs. I finally got around to listening to it, and it flipped me smooth out, Clark says. I was making everybody listen to it. I was just obsessed. Then one day I was walking through a restaurant and saw a friend, an Irish guitar player. He introduced me to this guy he was sitting with. I took one look at him and pegged him for a French blues singer. I went on and sat down, and then finally lights and bells went off. That was the guy who left me all those incredible songs. Within a year, Lovett had publishing and recording deals. His first album, Lyle Lovett, 1986, was the demo tape he had recorded in Arizona, dressed up with overdubbed vocals by Vince Gill and Roseanne Cash. Willie Nelson eventually covered two memorable songs for the record, Farther Down the Line and If I Were the Man You Wanted. In New York, several years later, at a songwriters' forum at the Bottom Line, Lovett once again jolted Guy Clark. I was up there with John Hiatt, Joe Ely, and Lyle, Clark says. The moderator asked all of us to play a song we wished we'd written. Lyle was two verses into his before the shock came to me what he was singing. Step Inside This House was literally the first song I ever wrote. I'd put it on a couple of rough demos. But how did that ever get to him? Through the osmosis by which popular music moves and thrives, Lovett had learned it from songwriter Eric Taylor. Lovett's debut was a mostly country album, though he showed his willingness to stretch the form with An Accepted Level of Ecstasy, The Wedding Song, an edgy glide through a big band bash at Houston's Warwick Hotel. Ever since, he has broadcast his eclectic songwriter schooling and put distance between himself and Nashville, with quirky humor, surreal storylines, and exotic arrangements. Even when his music sounded vaguely country, he couldn't resist poking fun at the genre, composing songs such as Creeps Like Me. What country DJ was going to put that on the playlist? In 1989, Lovett invoked shades of Benny Goodman and Artie Shaw with Lyle Lovett and His Large Band, a supremely confident deadpan smash. Behind all the tuxedos and brass, he showcased some of the best he had heard in Texas. Lovett used to open for Walter Hiatt, David Ball, and Champ Hood when they came together in the inventive jazzy acoustic trio Uncle Walt's Band, an act first championed by Willis Allen Ramsey. Now, Lovett brought them back for a one-time reunion. They had broken up in 1983. In the record's harmonic doo-wah closer, Once Is Enough. Lovett's album sales reached a high mark with the 1992 release of Joshua Judge's Ruth. Again, he extended the lessons of his teachers. Michael Murphy and other songwriters of the 70s lifted lyrics and strains from hymnals. Lovett added to his band a black gospel group that sounded as if it was wailing out of Houston's Fifth Ward. The ties that bound Joshua Judge's Ruth were going to church and funerals. Now my second cousin, his name was Calloway, he died when he'd barely turned two. It was peanut butter and jelly that did it, the help she didn't know what to do. She just stood there, and she watched him turn blue. 500,000 to 1 million albums sold is paltry commerce in some quarters of the music industry, but the revenue Lovett generates is sufficient that his record company lets him do whatever he wants. He has a loyal base of fans who have a high opinion of their intelligence and believe they hear it echoed in his music. When did Lovett stop being merely a singer and songwriter and become an icon of the cool? Probably when the movies, the ultimate in American celebrity, came to him. Director Robert Altman saw Lovett play a concert, called him, and asked if he was interested in acting. He was. Lovett fared well in small parts as a detective in Altman's The Player, 1992, and a baker in his Short Cuts, 1993. Like Willie Nelson before him, Lovett was put on screen essentially to play himself. During that period, he recorded Creeps Like Me, and while that is not exactly how Altman has typecast him, the director clearly sees in Lovett's face and mannerisms an intriguing oddball. Another Altman movie featuring Lovett, titled Cookie's Fortune, is set for release next year. Reaction to Lovett's recent performance in a larger role as a straight-arrow sheriff in director Don Roos's The Opposite of Sex has been mixed, to put it mildly. But he's not in the market for a career change. Music is still his meat and potatoes. Acting is just gravy. Sometime during his early romance with Hollywood, Lovett began his romance with Julia Roberts, forever solidifying his reputation as a ladies' man, however shy and awkward. He played this role with his usual sly charm on a 1992 Austin City Limits. Stammering and cutting his eyes, he regaled the crowd with a lead-in routine. I'd like to make a special dedication to anyone in this audience this evening who has ever been involved in a romantic relationship of any kind. He clung to his guitar and squinted as the crowd tittered. And, who may have had that relationship not work out quite the way you'd hoped it would? More hoots as he ducked his head and squirmed. And, who may have tried to console himself or herself by rationalizing that the person who maybe initiated the breakup of the relationship would one day live to regret it. The song was called She's Leaving Me Because She Really Wants To. It was dusk when we started talking, and now the sky outside the New York hotel is the hue of eggplant. I pick up the tape recorder to see if it's still rolling and can't tell. I can barely see the legal pad I'm writing on. The room is dark when Lovett jerks his chin, rises slowly from his chair, and turns on the lights. We had been talking about the craft of songwriting. There was a folk music scene in Houston in the late 60s, he continues. Guy Clark, Townes Van Zandt, and Jerry Jeff Walker were all living there. I never got to see any of that, but when I came along, I'd be playing clubs there and hear the stories. Those guys had an artistic approach to songwriting. They didn't talk about what buttons you had to push to get a song on the radio. They talked about the merits of the song. Lovett's close friend, Walter Hyatt, one of the best-liked Austin musicians of the 70s, died in the Value Jet crash in the Florida Everglades 2 years ago. Then last year, Townes Van Zandt succumbed to his demons and vices. I'd been thinking, he says, about making this record for a while, and that helped me decide not to wait any longer. I had to set parameters for myself because there were so many possibilities. It was not my intention to represent Texas singer-songwriters, the whole scope of Texas music, in an academic way. That's impossible. I decided to stick to songs that were really a part of my life, starting with the ones I'd played in that restaurant on Farm to Market 1960 when I was 18 years old. That said, it's almost as if Lovett went out of his way on Step Inside This House to help the heirs of Hyatt and Van Zandt. Each songwriter has 4 songs on the album. At first, the cuts I found myself playing over and over were Ramsey's Sleepwalking and Fromhold's droll Bears. But the one that grew on each hearing is a moody and complex love song called Ballad of the Snow Leopard and the Tanqueray Cowboy, written by musician and former practicing Austin lawyer David Rodriguez, a man who now lives in Holland. Rodriguez's lyrics and melody carry Lovett about as far as he's gone as a singer. Michael Murphy's West Texas Highway stirs memories of his cosmic cowboy heyday in Austin. Rollin' by Robert Earl Keen, Lovett's friend from those days, and what was then musically an Aggie backwater, explores the same theme with more drama and power. Most of the honky-tonking is old-fashioned and muted. The tracks seldom add more than a clean blending of mandolin, dobro, cello, and guitar. Lovett wants you to hear the writer's lines and what his lolling tenor voice brings to them. Not all of these songwriters got the recognition they deserve, Lovett muses, but in a way, their work translated into an enduring part of mainstream music. Austin music in the 70s was about freedom and rebellion, and that wasn't just happening in Texas. It was closely related to Southern rock. Now, Southern rock comes packaged as mainstream country. That's right, I say with a smile, thinking of all the loud, overproduced pap blaring forth now from kicker stations. Nashville country is the genuine redneck rock. We've finished the coffee and talked until I'm no longer taking notes. I can't separate my reaction to your record from my affection for that time in my life, I tell him. What about people in your audience who have never heard of this material or these guys? I can't believe that people who like my music aren't going to love these songs. For one thing, I've been performing them all along. At a party, somebody hands me a guitar. I don't want to sing one of my songs, so I sing one of these. They listen to it. They respond. Was it hard to decide on the list? Not really. I didn't have to learn one new song, but it did force me to look twice as hard at myself as a singer. What do you mean? Well, it's really different from recording your own stuff. It's a different responsibility. You want to respect the original version and the songwriter's intent, and at the same time, not to do a straight cover. Recording your own song, you can chalk off a lot to personal interpretation, kind of make it up as you go along. But when you're doing something that already exists, lots of people know how it goes, and you've got to get it right. Lovett rides down the elevator with me and says goodbye in the lobby. He has other appointments that will no doubt carry him deep into the pleasures of the New York night. As I watch him walk off, I think how success has changed him. It's made him about as cosmopolitan as they come. But I also think how some things never change, like knowing a good song when you hear it, and knowing how to sing it.
And it's the classic contradiction. It's the unavoidable affliction. But it don't take much to predict, son, the way it always goes.
As a postscript to the previous article, I'm going to read a few things off of Lyle Lovett's Wikipedia page. First, here are entries since that 1998 interview from his career section. We begin with the movie that was alluded to in the article. Lovett has acted in a number of films, including Cookie's Fortune, 1999, and composed for Dr. T and the Women, 2000. More recently, he has acted in The New Guy, 2002, and Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story, 2007. His television acting forays include Mad About You, Brothers and Sisters, The Bridge, Castle, and Dharma and Greg. The Bloodhound Gang song The Bad Touch does a reference to Lovett, and you'll love it just like Lyle. Lovett was given an award called the Esky for Surest Thing in Esquire's 2006 Esky Music Awards in the April issue. The magazine said of Lovett, "The secret of Lyle Lovett's endurance comes down to the three C's: class, charisma, and consistency. In the studio and on stage with his giant orchestra, he spent two decades gracefully matching genuine songcraft with A-list musicianship." In 2010, Lovett appeared on an episode of Spectacle, Elvis Costello With, which also included John Prine and Ray LaMontagne. He appeared on Castle in Season 3, Episode 9, in the role of a government agent. In 2011, Lovett was named Texas State Artist Musician by the Texas Commission on the Arts. Lovett contributed a cover of Buddy Holly's Well All Right for the tribute album Listen to Me, Buddy Holly, released in September 2011. In 2013, Lovett appeared in Episode 2 of The Bridge, an FX series, as Flagman, a lawyer. Lovett plays a humorous role in Angels Sing, a family Christmas movie released by Lionsgate. Lovett appears alongside fellow music celebrities Willie Nelson and Harry Connick Jr., and actor-musicians Connie Britton, Kris Kristofferson, and others. In 1995, Lovett performed a duet with Randy Newman on You've Got a Friend in Me for Toy Story. On October 24, 2019, Lovett was inducted into the Austin City Limits Hall of Fame.
Everything is not enough, and nothing is too much to bear. Where you've been is good and gone, all you keep's the getting there. Well, to live's to fly, all low and high. So shake the dust off of your wings and the sleep out of your eyes.
Hello, this is Michael reading for Texas Monthly Archives. Feature: The Great Late Towns Van Zandt. He was a reckless drunk and a hopeless idealist, but he was also the best Texas songwriter of our time. Just ask Willie Nelson, Lyle Lovett, Nancy Griffith, and countless others who knew him well. By Michael Hall. Published March 1998. Towns Van Zandt perched on a chair in the little nightclub in Berlin and sang for an hour and a half. It was October 1990. He was sober, which was a surprise. He was soulful and funny, which wasn't. The adoring audience sat transfixed through his entire set. The precise playing, the weary singing, the apt covers like Fraulein, the country chestnut. The Germans loved him. They knew his lyrics by heart, though most of his jokes sailed over their heads. 2.5 years later, Towns played at La Zona Rosa in Austin. He was so drunk he couldn't finish a single song during the entire abbreviated set. Embarrassed fans started filing out after 15 minutes as he fumbled with chords and slurred his words into gibberish. Some stuck it out to the end, feeling guilty for watching, but, well, you never knew what might happen when Towns Van Zandt was on stage. After the show, he collapsed. Towns was a holy mess. His life, a mix of the sublime and the horrific. By the time he died of a heart attack at 52 on New Year's Day 1997, the Fort Worth native had written a large batch of enduring songs and became the subject of colorful tales, many of them even true. They will be retold on March 28th when Austin City Limits airs a celebration of Towns Van Zandt, during which Emmylou Harris, Willie Nelson, Lyle Lovett, Nancy Griffith, Steve Earle, Guy Clark, and others reminisce about their friend and play his songs. At the taping of the show on December 7th, Nelson and Harris did Poncho and Lefty, which he and Merle Haggard took to number one on the country charts in 1983. Harris and Earle sang If I Needed You, which she and Don Williams took to number three in 1981. Griffith sang Tacuzma Valley, and Lovett, Flying Shoes, as each had been doing in concert for years. Griffith called Towns one of our greatest native folk songwriters. Before the show, Susanna Clark, who was one of Towns' best friends, recalled how her husband, Guy, and Rodney Crowell reacted to seeing a TV interview with Griffith after he died. Griffith had said, "If there weren't a Towns Van Zandt, there would be no Nancy Griffith." Hearing that, Crowell said, "There'd be no Rodney Crowell." Guy said, "There'd be no Guy Clark." You could add Lovett, Earle, Jimmy Dale Gilmore, and John Ely to that list, as well as hundreds of wannabes with acoustic guitars and whiskey visions learning to play Poncho and Lefty, analyzing every twist and shade in its melody and lyrics, and dreaming of the open road. For better or worse, Towns was the most influential Texas songwriter of his time. And yet he remains today what he was all his wild, heartbreaking life, a cult artist honored by his peers and ardent fans, but largely unknown in the mainstream. He never released an album on a major label. He was never a music business professional and was never much concerned with his career. He was never concerned with much of anything, in fact, but writing, touring, and hanging out with friends and family. He loved paradox, living it and spreading it. Born into comfort, he preferred the company of the poor and desperate, and sometimes gambled away what money he had. He was a light-hearted prankster who wrote some of the saddest songs of the century. He sang about how precious it was to be alive, yet spent a good deal of his life killing himself with drugs and alcohol. A kind of death cult grew up around him, fed by stories and myth, some of his own making, some of his fans, many of whom saw romance in his self-destruction. When he died on January 1, 1997, the same day as his hero, Hank Williams, had died in 1953, the most surprising thing was that he had lived so long. Everything is not enough. John Townes Van Zandt, born on March 7, 1944, was groomed to be an entirely different kind of Texas legend. His great-great-grandfather, Isaac Van Zandt, was an original son of the Republic, appointed charge d'affaires to the United States by Sam Houston in 1842. Isaac died while running for governor 5 years later. Van Zandt County, about 50 miles east of Dallas, is named for him. Succeeding generations of Van Zandts were civic leaders who built up Fort Worth from a dusty cow town to a transportation hub of the New West. Towns got his name from John Charles Towns, his great-grandfather on his mother's side, for whom Towns Hall, the main building at the University of Texas at Austin School of Law, is named. When Towns was 9, he saw Elvis Presley on the Ed Sullivan Show and asked his father for a guitar for Christmas. After promising to learn Fraulein as his first song, he got one. Although the family moved around a lot, his middle-class childhood was happy. He wrestled and played baseball and football, and he loved practical jokes. "He was a happy-go-lucky, funny kid," says his older sister, Donna Spence. "And he was smart." "Towns was a genius," says his first wife, Fran Lohr. "They couldn't test him because his IQ was so high, way above 140. For his last 2 years of high school, his parents sent him to the exclusive Shattuck Military Academy in Faribault, Minnesota, where, he later said, he got a real serious private prep school ivy-covered education. He loved Shakespeare's plays and sonnets and wrote many poems of his own. Towns was basically primped to be a Texas senator or lawyer, says John Townes Van Zandt II, his son by marriage to Fran, and for a while he played along. He enrolled at the University of Colorado at Boulder in 1962, wrote poetry, played the guitar for fun, and listened to records by Lightnin' Hopkins and Hank Williams. He was a good student who was popular with his professors. Towns met Fran, and the two started dating. Not all, however, was well. In the spring of his sophomore year, his parents, who were living in Houston, flew to Boulder to bring him home. "They thought he was binge drinking and suicidal," remembers Fran. Towns's parents admitted him to the UT Medical Branch in Galveston for 3 months of insulin shock treatment. "It was a time when they used extreme measures for things like that," says Fran. "He seemed okay to me. He seemed like a normal college student." In the spring of 1965, Towns enrolled at the University of Houston as a pre-law student and pledged a fraternity. He and Fran married in August, and soon after, he tried to join the Air Force. "He wanted the adventure, and he wanted the discipline," Fran says. Yet the doctors at UTMB wouldn't let him go, calling him an acute manic depressive who has made minimal adjustments to life. If he had a problem, his sister thought, it was that he felt too much. "You and I would hear about a starving person and go about our lives," says Donna, "but it would just break his heart." Fran remembers him happily giving his money away and once bringing a homeless man home to their Houston apartment. After years of playing the guitar for himself and his friends and family, Towns decided to play in front of strangers. He hung out at Houston's Jester Lounge, where he listened to and then opened for artists like Hopkins, Guy Clark, Jerry Jeff Walker, and Doc Watson. He developed a wheeling, flat-picking style from listening to Hopkins, and he started writing. At first, novelty songs like Fraternity Blues. Towns later told Austin DJ Larry Monroe that he heard Bob Dylan's The Times They Are A-Changin' and decided, this is what I'm gonna do. Nothing is too much to bear. If music was in his heart, he was still studying to be a lawyer. A lot of Towns was doing things because it was what he was supposed to do, says Fran. But in January 1966, Towns's father died at age 52, prompting him to leave school for good, turn his back on the past, and do what a musician was supposed to do. For the first time, he went on the road, playing shows with Walker and Clark, and he began to write serious songs. One of the first was Waitin' Around to Die, a roadmap for his adult years. I guess I'll keep gamblin', lots of booze and lots of ramblin'. Aw, it's easier than just waitin' around to die. He purposely set out to live by those words, telling Fran that you were living a lie if you sang the blues and hadn't lived them. In 1967, Towns went to Nashville, where a tape he had made caught the attention of Kevin Eggers, who was looking for acts for his fledgling independent label, Poppy Records. The following year, Eggers released Towns' first album, For the Sake of the Song, which contained some of Van Zant's most despairing songs, Waitin' Around to Die, Tecumseh Valley, plus bizarre kitsch like The Velvet Voices and All Your Young Servants. Over the next 5 years, the Texas Blue Blood turned Texas Bluesman cut 5 more albums, all on Tiny Poppy. They were sometimes overproduced and frilly, the Nashville sound threatening his dark vision, but the songs he wrote during this period were some of his best. Influenced by Shakespeare as much as Williams and Dylan, they told of the romance of rambling, the precious weight of moments, the quiet glories and sore failures of love, and the utter aloneness of human beings. They were odes to joy that had no sentimentality, blues numbers that had no self-pity, and sad songs that made people feel good. Towns believed that the sky was full of songs just waiting to be pulled in. He said that Poncho and Lefty came through the window of a seedy hotel room, and that If I Needed You came to him in his sleep, in a flu-driven fever dream. I was just tapped on the shoulder from above and told to write these songs, as opposed to wanting to be a success in the music business, he told writer Don McLeese. What I do is, between me and the Lord, to examine and possibly alter the state of grace in which I live, and thereby the state of grace of anybody who listens. His impact was indisputable. Emmylou Harris remembers him seeing play Gerd's Folk City in New York in 1968 or 1969. I was stunned, she said at the Austin City Limits taping. I had never really seen anything like that before. I thought he was the ghost of Hank Williams with a twist. In 1969, Towns was in Lubbock, hitchhiking to Houston, his backpack crammed with copies of Our Mother the Mountain, but no clothes, when he was picked up by Joe Ely. He gave Ely a record, and that night, Ely and Jimmy Dale Gilmore stayed up listening to it and learning to play the songs. Every song seemed like a dream, Ely says now. They were painted dark shades of blue. So, it turns out, was Towns. In 1971, he overdosed on heroin and almost died. In 1975, the country music documentary Heart-Worn Highways, he's seen wandering playfully around an Austin backyard in the middle of the day with a bottle of whiskey, a can of Coke, and a BB gun. Given his bouts of deep depression and his adventures of manic frenzy, people took literally the title of his sixth album, The Late Great Townes Van Zandt, though Eggers says it was a goof on the non-existence of his career. Stories of his reckless ways were told and retold. One of the most notorious involved a drunken Steve Earle, an angry Townes, and a five-in-the-morning game of Russian roulette. Or maybe it was a calm Townes and an angry Earle. Either way, the inveterate gambler was lucky. He was very similar to Hank Williams, says Eggers' brother, Harold, Townes' longtime road manager and sometimes manager. He was running himself into a wall. Townes spent most of the 70s moving between Austin, Houston, Nashville, New York, and the mountains around Crested Butte, Colorado. He and Fran divorced in 1970. Sometime during the next decade, he married and divorced again. He was living the life he was writing about, traveling, lighting for a while, then traveling again. John remembers spending a year with his father in Austin, listening to all these unrecognized folk players and pickers drink and play every night until morning. Maybe because Townes had grown up in one elite society, he rejected another. The rarefied hierarchy of the Nashville music scene. He surrounded himself with desperate people, says John. He didn't have to explain his way of living to them. In whatever town he played, says Harold Eggers, he would go down to Skid Row and give each of the winos $5. He almost resented money, Eggers says. Where you been is good and gone. Townes' final decade gave him plenty to be happy about. In 1987, he released his first album of new songs in 9 years, At My Window, on a new label, Sugar Hill Records. Then 43, he was living in Nashville with his third wife, Janine, and their 4-year-old son, Will. Their daughter, Katie Bell, would be born in 1992. He had an extraordinary collection of songs to his credit, and many of the artists he had inspired 10 and 20 years before, Earl, Eli, Gilmore, Harris, Lovett, Crowell, Butch Hancock, and Lucinda Williams, were making albums of their own. Now a new generation of musicians was discovering him. The Seattle proto-grunge band Mudhoney recorded his Buckskin Stallion Blues with Gilmore. The Canadian folk rockers Cowboy Junkies invited him to tour with them and recorded a couple of his songs. But for every high in Townes' life, there was a low. A life of hard living had taken its toll. You could hear it in his voice, which was lower and thinner and halting. He often spoke his lyrics instead of singing them. You could hear it in his new songs, which came less frequently and had less subtlety than his earlier work. He told Janine that A Song For, the unrelenting, bleak first song on 1994's No Deeper Blue, was a suicide note. You could see it in his live performances, where he sometimes seemed to be dying on stage. He went into detoxification programs a dozen times, by John's reckoning, though he'd have to bottom out before he'd go. Unfortunately, someone who is as afflicted as Townes, he has to drink, says his friend Steve Weiner. He would try to ration it out. He had stopped drinking between 4 and 9 p.m. on the day of a show. Of course, he sometimes crossed the line, as he did that night at La Zona Rosa. Yet, crowds would come, partly out of curiosity, to see if he'd crash, but mostly because when Townes was on this side of the line, and especially when he was close to it, his heart and humor filled the room. He showed his innermost pain under the spotlight, says Ely. He'd start crying in the middle of a show. I mean, nobody does that. Over and over, he told the same corny jokes. What's white and crawls up your leg? Uncle Ben's perverted rice. After the darkest of songs, as if to say, hey, lighten up. He loved playing in front of people. He felt safe on stage, he told Harold Eggers, and he especially loved touring. John remembers a show his father did at Austin's Cactus Cafe in 1996. He was real shaky, trying not to drink too much and blow the gig. He had his microphone cord wrapped around his guitar strap, and he was struggling with the strap. The crowd began murmuring, and finally, the sound man ran up and fixed the strap. It was a 40-second ordeal. It was so quiet that you could hear a pin drop. Towns looked up from his lap, still shaky, and said, "It gets much worse." The way he laughed, everyone roared in laughter. It was a great show once he had played a few songs and got into it. The only thing Towns ever wanted, he told Janine, was to write the perfect song that would save somebody's life. The only thing his friends and family wanted was to help him save himself. After the debacle at La Zona Rosa, he let Weiner take him to a Nashville treatment center, but not before having a drink in the Dallas airport. "Amigo, I've been drinking for 30 years, Towns told him. "You can't feel guilty that you can't stop me." Most everyone tried to get him to slow down, and most everyone failed. "When I told him he drank too much," says Susanna Clark, he'd say, "Susanna, there's sober people in India." Towns deteriorated rapidly in his last 3 years, almost dying in 1994 when Janine, by then his third ex-wife, drove him to Vanderbilt Hospital in Nashville for pneumonia. Then, on Christmas Eve 1996, he fell and hurt his hip. A week later, he agreed to go to the hospital, where doctors said the hip was broken. After making Janine promise not to leave him there, he let doctors operate him at 1 in the morning on January 1st. Janine took him home later that day. At 10 that evening, while lying in bed nibbling on cheese, crackers, sliced apples, and roast beef, with Will and Katie Bell nearby, and Janine on the phone with Susanna Clark, Towns had a heart attack and died. He told me 3 or 4 times in the last 3 or 4 years that he had lived to be 52, says Steve Weiner. His father had died of a heart attack at 52. Towns was sure the same fate would befall him. All you keep's the getting there. Towns had 2 funerals, one for each of his lives. The service in the North Texas town of Dido, where his father was born, was mostly a family affair. Some of his ashes were buried under a headstone bearing the epitaph, "To Lives to Fly." The service in Nashville, by contrast, was a music business happening. It grew so big that it had to be moved at the last minute from a funeral home to a large church. Friends like Steve Earle and Lyle Lovett eulogized him and sang songs. As often happens after the death of someone famous, especially someone mischievous enough to tell writers what they wanted to hear, the tributes and obituaries missed some things, like his sense of humor, and printed exaggerations of the legend. The New York Times, for instance, pegged him as a rich kid who had spent many of his teenage years in a mental institution and ate dog food to survive as a poor musician. As also happens when someone famous dies, squabbling erupted over Towns' legacy. For several years now, fans have awaited a 60-song multi-CD set from Tomato, formerly Poppy, that was recorded in 1991 and contains new versions of his songs. That in itself would be nothing extraordinary, but the premise was that all of the songs would be duets with Towns and one or another of his various admirers. Almost half of the collaborators have already sung their parts, including Willie Nelson, Freddie Fender, Jerry Jeff Walker, and Emmylou Harris. Towns was sober when he recorded his vocals, says Kevin Eggers, who calls them magical. But there's a problem. According to Janine, Eggers got Towns' blessing to bring in a group of backup singers to sing on 5 songs during the recording sessions. 2 years later, she says, Eggers brought them back to sing on 25 more songs without Towns' knowledge. "And they drown him out," Eggers retorts, that they've always been on the songs and that Towns loved them. Although Janine has threatened to sue to prevent release, it can't come out with those cows mooing over towns. Eggers will put out a single CD sampler this April and the whole set by next year. Or at least those are his plans. I will put the records on a shelf, he says, if she keeps harassing me. Janine often inserted herself into the thick of Townes' career when he was alive, and her continuing to do so after his death bothers some, who point out that she is his ex-wife, not his widow. Then again, their divorce decree gave her all the copyrights that he owned, and she is co-executor with John of his estate. Janine says that she and Harold Eggers took care of Townes during his last 15 years, even after their divorce, and with their two children to raise, she's not going to stop now. Which is to say, the estate hopes to put out an album of its own, just Townes and his guitar, two new songs, plus Poncho and Lefty, and the other usual suspects. At the time of his death, Townes and Steve Shelley of Sonic Youth were making another album, this one for Geffen Records, which would have been his major label debut. He got a kick out of being discovered by the younger generation. "I'm in the mold that grunge was grown in," he would tell Janine, who is buying the masters from Geffen for a possible future release. They cut four songs, including Screams from the Kitchen, whose chorus is, "Goodbye to the highway, goodbye to the sky, I'm headed out, goodbye, goodbye." To Lives to Fly Low and High. Guy Clark opened the Austin City Limits show by telling how Townes had had an epiphany in school when a teacher was talking about how the sun was eventually going to burn out. Townes said he snapped and said, "Hold it. Do you mean I'm supposed to be here on time, shine my shoes, sit up straight, pay attention, and the sun is burning out? Man, are you hip? The sun's burning out." Then Clark played To Lives to Fly, Townes' quiet masterpiece of affirmation in the face of despair and loss. If waiting around to die was his roadmap, To Lives to Fly was his statement of purpose. He wasn't the best gambler, but he was lucky. Whether touched on the shoulder by God or just plain touched, he figured out what he was supposed to do. Write songs, sing, save lives, fly, and like the punchline to one of his bad jokes, crash. It's funny how sometimes those who are so good at dying are so good at living. To Townes Van Zandt, that was the best joke of all, and he got to tell it over and over again.
Sometimes I don't even know the reason why, but I guess I keep a gambling, lots of booze and lots of rambling. Well, it's easier than just a waiting around to die.
As a postscript to the previous article, I'm going to read a portion of Townes Van Zandt's Wikipedia entry. Legacy. Legal issues over his work. In the years immediately following Van Zandt's death, his former manager and label owner, Kevin Eggers, issued 14 albums of both new and previously unreleased material by the singer, all without consent of his estate, represented by Janine Van Zandt and his three children. Eggers claimed a 50% interest in 80 of Van Zandt's songs. After nearly 10 years of legal battles, the court sided with the estate, issuing injunctive relief against Eggers, restraining him from reproducing or distributing any of Van Zandt's songs. It was revealed through these proceedings that Van Zandt's annual income in the years before his death had climbed to over $100,000, thanks in part to the royalties accrued from his songs being covered by Willie Nelson, Emmylou Harris, Lyle Lovett, Merle Haggard, Cowboy Junkies, and other major music stars. After Van Zandt's death, his road manager, Harold Eggers, released video and audio recordings from the songwriter's concerts. An out-of-court settlement in 2006 granted the Van Zandts conditional control of Harold Eggers' mastered recordings, while Eggers retaining a 50% ownership of seven albums and some royalties for the remaining recordings. On October 21, 2008, A number of Van Zandt's personal possessions were auctioned off at the North Side in Akron, Ohio, at a benefit for Rex Bell, a close friend and bandmate who was the inspiration for the song Rex's Blues. Bell was part owner of the bar in Houston where Towns recorded his album Live at the Old Quarter. Bell now owns the new Old Quarter in Galveston.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear Recording Library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
And all the federales say they could have had him any day. They only let him hang around out of kindness, I suppose.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 51 and clear. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the low 50s.
From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Hi folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the Make-Believe Ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts, Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S. as well as in the U.K., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world, and from coast to coast on public and community radio stations as well as many college and university radio stations, welcome to the Make-Believe Ballroom, and thanks for joining me this hour as I share some wonderful swing, jazz, and big band music, and many of the stories behind the records, and the personalities who recorded them. Hope you're all doing well. You know, coming into the Crystal Studio today, I thought it would be great to devote this program to vocalists, crooners, singers, and vocal groups from the 1930s and 1940s. Now, I've done shows on vocalists in the past, so this program's not a top 10 or anything like that. It's just a continuation of the shows I've done. And thinking back, I don't think I ever did a block on crooners and the origins of the crooner. Crooning really started with the advent of the microphone. Before the mic, singers really had to project to be heard in the back rows of concert halls and theaters. Think of Al Jolson or Sophie Tucker belting one out, or opera singers, for that matter, for the more cultured of us. So when microphones started to come into fashion, most notably on the radio, the emerging crooners were able to sing in a more personal and some say sensual style. And because of this style, early crooners actually created controversy, some creating controversy in a moral sense. Cardinal William O'Connell of Boston and the New York Singing Teachers Association, they both publicly denounced the vocal form. Cardinal O'Connell calling it base, degenerate, defiling, and un-American. Can it really get any worse than that? With the Teachers Singing Association adding the word corrupt. Even the New York Times, the paper of record, predicted that crooning would be just a passing fad. The newspaper wrote, quote unquote, "They sing like that because they can't help it. Their style is begging to go out of fashion. Crooners will soon go the way of tandem bikes, mahjong, and midget golf." Well, there's certainly no more midget golf, thankfully, but we do still have tandem bikes and mahjong, so it seems the Times was literally singing the wrong tune. In my estimation, if you had a Mount Rushmore of crooners, the faces of Bing Crosby, Rudy Valley, and Russ Colombo would be chiseled into the rock. Now, many men of the era seem to be threatened by these vocal notables for their smooth voices and sexual appeal. So much so that in a 1931 record, aptly named Crosby, Colombo, and Valley, vocalist Dick Robertson, he laments these public enemies.
Hi-ho, everybody. There's lots of public enemies, but I know only three. Crosby, Colombo, and Valley. They've made a million married women wish that they were free. Crosby, Colombo, and Valley. Those crooning vagabonds are stealing all our blondes. Now I know what has become of Sally. And every time you kiss your girl, who is she thinking of? Crosby, Colombo, and Valley. Listen, all you bachelors, all you married men, we must stick together once again. There's too many crooners, too many saxophones, breaking up our happy home. Who always sings about a couple needs the stars above? Crosby, Colombo, and Valley. And though I call it nonsense, they insist that it is love. Crosby, Colombo, and Valley. Before the radio, a married man could throw any gigolo out in the alley. But now who comes into your home and you can't say a word? Crosby, Colombo, and Valley. Each time I go out, all I hear him talk about is this Crosby, the Colombo, and the Valley. You know, I buy the banana from the Greek, and all the time I hear him speak about this Crosby, Colombo, and the Valley. I buy the radio, and I tune him soft and low, and I hear him sing, and I like him too, by golly. Everything will be okay if they sing Pagliacci someday, this Crosby, Colombo, and the Valley. Our children think America was first discovered by Crosby, Colombo, and Valley. The women only laugh at me, but who can make them cry? Crosby, Colombo, and Valley. A girl can close her eyes and listen to those guys and do what Trilby did to old Svengali. My baby can't say Poppy yet, but he can plainly say Crosby, Colombo, and Valley.
So let's listen to the three public enemies. First, Crosby. "Where the blues of the night meets the gold of the day" was the theme Bing Crosby selected for his radio show. It was recorded in November 1931 with Bernie Kruger and his orchestra. The song was originally titled "When the Gold of the Day Meets the Blues of the Night," but the title was changed before recording for reasons I really don't know. If you do know the answer to that one, you can email me at jeff@makebelieveballroomradio.com. Now, they're Bingle.